The Process, a podcast about creativity and experimental music. In the world of experimental music, outcomes and accolades for creators can be uncertain and at times seem far and few between. Therefore, creators and practitioners of experimental music must embrace the one thing they will always have complete control over, the process. This podcast aims to understand this creative process by listening to new works and discussing them with their creators. Each episode focuses on one creator and their music. Understanding how and why they create can inform aspiring creatives and help audiences better understand and navigate experimental music. I'm Dr. Doug Bielmeyer, and I'll be your host as we explore the world of experimental music, creativity, and the human need to find purpose in their world and lives. This is The Process. Eli Field Steele is an American composer currently living in Urbana, Illinois, where he is assistant professor of composition theory and director of the Experimental Music Studios at the University of Illinois. His music has been performed nationally and internationally, published under Lovebird Music, and has been recorded on the Seamus and Arrowcade music record labels. On today's episode, we listen to Impulse Curve, performed on his custom light-sensitive control surface. To check out the video of Eli's performance, follow the YouTube link in the episode description.
When I'm working on a new work, a new composition, I'm focused almost entirely on the sound.
Yeah.
What I don't do is focus on extra musical concepts, narratives.
Yeah.
Like I'm rarely sort of inspired by a specific event or a specific place.
Mm-hmm.
I work a lot in synthesis and sampling and experimental digital audio manipulations. Mm-hmm. And I sort of just sit down and play and see what comes to the surface. And some of my works, my most recent work that I'm working on, this is not Impulse Curve, but something even newer.
Yeah.
I began by going through a list of objects I wanted to record that has been building up over the past year or two.
Yeah.
I have a bunch of PVC pipe. I have these slinkies. I have really squeaky bicycle brakes.
Yes.
And I went into the studio and did kind of a 6-hour experimental recording session, just capturing all of this. And then I sit down with my computer and I start, you know, loading these sounds into buffers and playing them forwards and backwards and slower and faster and combining them and applying all sorts of effects and just kind of tinkering. And that kind of leads, one idea leads to another and, you know, a piece is born.
So it's kind of, you know, like a traditional sort of sound collage type, you know, a process. But it's interesting what you said about like what inspires you. A lot of people come on the show and that, you know, they talk about like going for a walk or going to an art gallery or some, or even watching a movie, something extra musical, but still art. So you kind of mentioned maybe that's not exactly what inspires you. In fact, maybe the tinkering is what inspires you.
Yeah, I think I'm just inspired by sound itself. Mm-hmm. When I happen upon a really exciting sound, something that I created or something that somebody else created, or I'm just sort of perusing, you know, YouTube or whatever.
Right.
And I hear something, you know, maybe it's, I don't exactly know how it was made, but it suggests certain timbral, textural qualities, maybe evokes something extra musical.
Yeah.
But I think at the heart of it, I just really think the sound is fascinating.
Yeah.
And combinations of sounds are fascinating, and the way sounds lead from one to the other and how soundscapes transition over time. It's all just, I mean, when it's done right, it just envelops you like a warm hug, and it's great. And it's great to be the one making the sounds too.
Yeah, you know, I found almost too manipulating a sound and really breaking it down into its, you know, smaller parts. You almost learn more about the sound, and maybe sometimes your appreciation of that sound, like where does that come from? You know, why do I appreciate the sound so much? Why did it resonate with me? So I love this idea that you did sort of like a Foley recording, or you did some recordings, studio recordings of sounds. You had like a list going. I love that. So like some people keep a list of melodies or a list of different things. You have a list of like cool sounds I need to record, like in the studio.
Yeah, it's on a text file on my computer called Sound Ideas.
Sound Ideas, great, great. So you have these sound ideas, you record them, and they're already now in a DAW, or they're in, you might have mentioned maybe Super Collider or buffers or Max, and so they're in there, and you're starting to manipulate them digitally. So are you kind of creating a sort of sound library of these sounds, like with this effect, without it, you know, is that what you're doing, or are you guided more by a specific mission?
It's a pretty formless, aimless process most of the time. And I'm usually working in Super Collider and, you know, don't want to get too jargony here.
Right. Yeah.
But what I end up doing is just building these objects called synth defs, which are basically instruments.
Yep.
They're like a recipe for how sound is made. Mm-hmm. So one synth def might contain some oscillators, some sample players, some filters, and just various ways these processors and generators are interconnected.
Mm-hmm.
And I will also use a library of objects called patterns, which are basically sequencers.
Mm-hmm.
And I will just kind of conjure up these various little modules that produce a single sustained sound, or maybe a cluster of sounds, or maybe a rhythmic texture of sounds.
Mm-hmm.
And I just kind of file these away in text files, you know, and with comments, and I name the files in a way that I'll remember what's inside of them.
Mm-hmm.
And as I go, I just kind of, you know, every now and then I'll hit one and say, "Ooh, that's that is a good one." And I'll put a little asterisk next to it.
Yeah.
And I'm just kind of, what I'm looking for overall is opportunities for dynamic contrast.
Mm-hmm.
I think, you know, I don't want to get too philosophical here, but I think personally music, which sort of is all one thing, is a little boring. And I like if it's sort of all noise the whole time, or all consonants, or all, you know, I don't know. I bet there are lots of people who disagree with me, and I think that's totally A-okay.
Yeah.
But I find myself gravitating towards music that has contrast. And so you present some idea to the listener, to the ear, and that sets up expectations for what might come next. And then you might maybe fulfill those expectations, or maybe you don't, but then you present some other thing, which then shifts the context, and you're kind of on a journey over the course of the piece where things are, the landscape is changing sort of subtly, but and then by the end of it, you don't quite know how or why you ended up here, but it's different, and you know, it's kind of this magical transportative thing.
You know, and I think that's a more contemporary view on how to deal with quote-unquote samples. You know, the idea that you're taking a sound or you're recording a sound and you're manipulating it. And, you know, I think historically, you know, obscuring that idea, you know, the OJ Sonora type idea, like obscuring it and leaving it out, leaving the context out is part of the process. But and that could still be part of your process, but also thinking about expectations and thinking about context, it can be a lot of fun. So you have all these sound blocks, you have these sonic blocks, building blocks, if you will.
Yeah.
How does that become a piece, or how does that become part of a larger work?
Yeah. So when I have these blocks, I sometimes start to conceptualize them chronologically. They exist along an imagined timeline. And one of these blocks is activated and is playing. And you know, in the context of something like Super Collider, these sounds don't really have a lifespan. They're just kind of infinite until they are turned off or changed.
Right.
And so maybe the program is in a specific state for X amount of time.
Yeah.
And then at some point, I'll engage some other event or action, which maybe changes the first texture or unit or block or whatever, maybe adds additional blocks. And so I think I'm just kind of, for the most part, again, doing a block building thing. You start with the synthstep and you build unit generator blocks and signal blocks and you add those together. Then you have a unit and then you create some sequence, which then becomes a unit. And then you have these even larger units, which can be, you know, built into a large scale phrase or a large scale section or something like that. So for the most part, most of the time I end up thinking about it chronologically and it ends up being like this large 2-minute thing will be first and then it will transition into this second 2 or 3 minute long thing. In other cases, I end up not really thinking in terms of a timeline, but instead just mapping textures and units and blocks to some controller so that they can all be arbitrarily turned on or turned off and manipulated whenever I feel like it.
Right.
And this is actually the basis of Impulse Curve, where there's basically three soundscapes and I have the ability to turn them on independently and I can also enable interactive controls for each of the three sounds independently and that naturally kind of lends itself to a structure when it's performed, but and I've kind of usually stick with mostly the same structure, but if I wanted to I could do something different, start with the third sound instead of the first sound or something like that and just kind of improvise.
So is the form created more organically or in sort of like an improv type way that as you're triggering these different zones or different clusters that you're kind of, is there some experimentation that comes up to deciding the form, or do you say, hey, I have to make a 5.5 minute piece and I want A, B, and C to happen? Is it a combination of both or is it more the first or the latter?
I like providing improvisation opportunities for myself in terms of the in the moment performance form.
Okay.
I like that. It's more exciting.
Yeah. Absolutely.
I like to be able to say, this is what I'm going to do today. I'm going to push this button, and then I'm going to push this button.
Yeah.
And sometimes, you know, depending on the algorithmic choices the computer is making, I'll listen and say, oh, I'm going to hang around in this section for a while longer because I like what's going on.
Right.
Other times I'll say, well, that's no good. We'll turn that off and move on. So
is there notation involved in this? And does there need to be traditional notation involved in this?
I have been moving away from traditional notation pretty steadily and gradually for the past 8 to 10 years.
Yeah.
So for Impulse Curve, there's no notation.
Right.
The primary, there's a couple of reasons there's no notation. One is that they're usually for specific controllers and specific control schemes, which it's hard to provide instructions for that.
Right.
And if I were to give a piece to some other performer,
right.
It just introduces all of these obstacles and roadblocks and complications. Yeah. So it's usually me who's going to be performing it, and I don't need to write notation for myself.
Yeah.
And I also don't feel a need to sort of make concrete the music in notated form, even though it's kind of a very traditional thing to do, I guess. And, and there's some, in some cases, the score is considered the sort of the thing, right?
But there's sometimes they're a work of art in themselves, like just visually looking at them.
Yeah, absolutely.
When is the, or how do you finish a piece then? Is the piece finished once you've performed it once? And that can mean, you know, publicly at a concert. It could be an installation. It could just be in the studio. You've performed it once in the studio. So when is it done, or do you even care if they're done?
I think there's an intuitive sense to when a piece is done. When you've gotten all these sounds and you've, you know, either in a DAW arranged everything or in a program like Max or SuperCollider, you have all your modules built and you know, you start somewhere, some stuff happens in the middle, and then there's something that sounds like an ending. And and you know, that's kind of the cue for me. It's like, oh, I like how I feel after that complete run through. And I try not to be a perpetual tweaker, adjuster. And I think I'm usually pretty good about that. Especially once it's performed, or once I sort of render the piece out as an audio file and say, this is one example of what it might sound like. And the more I listen to it, the more I'm like, yeah, okay, that's what it sounds like. That's the piece. So, I think you just sort of know when a piece is done. So the instrument, which I've named Light Matrix, is a research project that I guess is technically still ongoing. Before I started teaching at the University of Illinois, I taught for 1 year at Ball State University in Muncie, Indiana.
In Indiana, yeah.
Yeah, and I it was a one-year position where I was filling in for a professor, Mike Pounds, who was on sabbatical. Yeah, and I was covering his teaching load. And one of those courses was human-computer interface design, which is basically kind of an Arduino class.
Sure.
And it was, I was totally new to the whole thing, so it was kind of a frantic, got to learn this stuff really quickly.
Yep.
And I built these sensor gloves, which out of bicycle gloves, and they have a photocell on the palm and an XY accelerometer on the back of the hand. And that was very exciting. Once that was finished, the piece is called Brain Candy. It's also on my YouTube channel. So when I got to Illinois, I wanted to do a kind of go big or go home thing.
Yeah, because that maybe had one or two sensors on it, and I believe the Light Matrix has over like 256 photosensors. Is that correct?
The sensor gloves have a total of 6 independent data streams.
Okay.
And Light Matrix has 256.
Yeah.
And I know.
So much bigger, much bigger, much better.
Yes, much bigger. Yeah. And I know podcasting is not a visual medium, but you can see the prototype kind of in the background here, this thing over here.
Oh, on the floor there. Yeah.
Yeah, that's a version of Light Matrix which is all insulated wire and breadboards. And I got about halfway through and it was working, but then I realized this cannot travel. It's just if it gets bumped, it's ruined.
Yeah.
So I collaborated with a pair of electrical engineering undergraduates here in their senior design course, and they basically helped me make version 2.0.
Awesome,
and that's the version you see in the YouTube video, and it's 256 photocells connected to an array of multiplexers, which all go into an Arduino, and the Arduino is basically taking a remote control and switching through these 256 different TV channels lightning fast. And so I'm just getting this serial stream of 256 data points from the Arduino into the computer again and again and again and again. So those just show up on a serial port connection. and I can map those 256 independent data streams onto whatever I like. So I have the ability to kind of treat an individual photo cell as a singular controller, like a button, just like I can cover it up, I can let light shine on it. Mm-hmm. Or I can average clusters of photo cells, you know, like rows or columns. Mm-hmm. It's just a matter of programming it and writing the algorithm.
I think one thing I observed in Impulse Curve, especially in the video, is that part of that piece was covering up the sensors. So, you know, the absence of light, or you sort of with your hand creating a shadow on those sensors. So then that seemed to be triggering, I think essentially it, at different parts, it was doing different things, but it, at least initially it was creating some type of dynamics or some type of volume response when you were covering up those sensors.
Yeah, that's actually the entire basis. I have, you know, like flashlights and things like that. I even have like these little like party plastic lights that go on tips of your fingers and stuff. I experimented with different things, but what I settled on, at least for this piece, and also for Depth of Field, which is the tenor saxophone duo, is I bought a little like reading light, an LED reading light that arc that stands up, and I have it like rubber banded to a brick, and it shines down. And the reason I did it this way is because I felt I had more control over the level of the ambient lights. So, because, of course, when you take this to a different space, a different concert venue, the lighting's all different. Right. And I built a sort of calibration algorithm, but it really helps to have this stand light because I put it in the same spot every time. I set it to the same setting, and I plug it in so it doesn't run out of battery, because if it's not plugged in, it gets dimmer and dimmer over the course of like an hour.
So then, does that affect the amount of dynamic range then in this particular piece then?
A little bit, yeah. But for the most part, the calibration algorithm supplements the fixed light source, and the two of them work together to make it pretty consistent. Mm-hmm. The whole concept is all three of these soundscapes are I shadow the photo cells, and that affects it. So the first thing you hear in the YouTube video is the first of these three sounds, which is this like chordal slow moving texture.
Yeah.
And that soundscape is listening to an average of all 256 photo cells. Mm-hmm. So it's basically taking all the values, averaging them together, and that singular value is mapped onto this parameter, which raises the amplitude and also widens a whole bunch of bandpass filters. Mm-hmm. So it goes from kind of pure filtered noise, like a tone-like quality, to like very noisy ocean waves kinds of things.
Mm-hmm. I noticed the first part you were making very large gestures. With your whole hand, and then at about I think it was about a minute in or about 2 minutes, then you were actually doing much smaller gestures sort of towards the edge of the interface.
Yeah, that's probably the third sound, the very glitchy sort of harsh sounds.
Yeah.
Those are most active when a very small number of photocells are being influenced.
I see.
So it's looking at any particular photocell and looking at its neighbors. Mm-hmm. And if it's only one photocell being manipulated, like if that's the only one that's changing the amount of light that's being received, then it kind of sparks to life and makes a bunch of glitch sounds. Mm-hmm. It's a little bit loosey-goosey with the responsiveness. Sometimes you touch it and it, you know, it's got a kind of a personality to it. The optimist in me wants to say you can't own an idea.
Mm-hmm.
Right? It's not, it's an idea. Once it's an idea, it lives, it exists, it's out there in the world. Sure. And, you know, as soon as you do something with it, you know, make a piece or make a project or make a piece of hardware or software or something, you've released your idea into the world. It's now a wild idea.
Right.
And but at the same time, yeah, I'm primarily using Super Collider, which it went free and open source some couple of decades ago, I think. Yeah. And it's just a kind of a, it's developed into this really awesome community of developers and users. And it's the reason I started making Super Collider tutorials on YouTube is just to kind of share and celebrate the fact that this is now a thing that everyone gets to use. And I mean, the reason I hesitate to just embrace this mindset is because people need to, you know, make money. And some people who have really good ideas should be rewarded for having those ideas. And, and you know, then you could maybe make the case that there's no incentive to come up with ideas if you can't monetize them or can't sort of leverage them in some way. For me, I am happy to make my ideas available to everyone. People email me and they say, hey, I really liked your piece. Could you send me the code?
Yeah.
And I say, here you go. You know, here you go. Here's the code. I mean,
there's famous stories about some composers, like, no one stands behind me when I perform. Like, no one stands behind the laptop while I perform because I don't want people to see what I'm doing. So there's, you know,
I get it. When I was a master's student at North Texas, my cohort, his name was Ilya, he would compare electroacoustic music to street magicianship. And like, it's sort of like a, it's a trick, right? It's like, it's you go and you do something and you kind of stun people and they're like, wait, how'd you do that?
It's
and
magic.
You're like, wow, it's magic.
Yeah.
And that always resonated with me. That stuck with me all these years.
Absolutely.
So I can see that where you've done something and you don't want other people to do it. Right. You want to keep it to yourself so that you're the only one doing it. And I get that. And I support that. I think if people want to do that, you do you. I find joy in sharing my ideas with the world. That's why I make tutorials. It's why I, you know, I most of the time people will say, you know, I'd be happy to pay you. I'd be happy to, you know, so that's always very nice. I feel like in general, people have a good mindset about it and they're willing to, you know, pay people what they're due for their work. But I also really just enjoy having ideas and then sharing them with people. Yeah.
Eli, this has been fantastic talking to you and hearing your opinions. It was fascinating to learn more about the Light Matrix. Before I let you go, can you tell us a little bit about how we can find out more about you and your music?
The best place to see what I'm up to is to subscribe to my YouTube channel. And it's just youtube.com/EliFieldsteel. So I've got some score videos there, a lot of Super Collider tutorials, and just kind of miscellaneous performance, code, art, sound stuff.
Thanks to Eli for sharing his time and music with us. As always, if you enjoyed this episode, please check out other episodes in the series. And as always, like, subscribe, or leave a comment on your preferred podcasting app. I'm Dr. Doug Bielmeyer, and this has been The Process.